This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and we begin with punk rock's early beginnings at a time and place where Motown was still king and disco was making some serious inroads. Eddie, I gotta say, when I first heard about this film and a chance to interview the co-director, I immediately thought this has Eddie Garcia written all over it. What an amazing story.
Thanks, David. Yeah, as Henry Rollins says in the film, this is the kind of story that keeps you going back to the record store. In fact, I'm eagerly awaiting my copy of the Death record on vinyl as we speak. It's fair to say I'm pretty obsessive about rock and roll, and this kind of underdog story is definitely right up my alley. So before the Clash, before the Sex Pistols or the Ramones, there was a band called Death. That's the name of the new music documentary, co-directed by my guest, Charlotte, North Carolina filmmaker Jeff Howlett.
Nobody was making music like that in 73.
Three black brothers from Detroit, Michigan.
What were they called?
They were called Death.
That's a good name.
Have you lost your mind?
The film explores the musical and personal relationships of the Hackney Brothers and their proto-punk band Death. The band formed in a Detroit bedroom in the early 70s, and the brothers recorded an album in 74 that collected dust until being released in 2009. Howlett's film traces the brothers' journey from obscurity to critical success, a journey that took over 30 years. You can see the film right now via iTunes or video on demand, but if, like me, you still dig the silver screen experience, it is screening in Greensboro at the Geeksboro Coffee House Cinema July 19th through the 25th. Check WFDD.org for details, including info on Geeksboro Coffee House's Q&A screenings with the filmmaker. I spoke to Jeff via phone from his office in Charlotte, but first, a little music. This song is called Rock and Roll Victim and comes courtesy of a band called Death. I expected to be excited about the music and learning about this band, but I didn't know just how in-depth we were going to get with the family and where it was going to go. It was such an incredible story about unheard music seeing the light of day, but it was really as much, if not more, a testament to the power of family and faith. Did you expect it would go in that direction when you set out to make it?
Just from the relationship I established then and just talking to fellows over the years, I just knew that there was a deep family story there, and just talking to other family members and everyone having so much affection and love for their brother David, we all just talked about this is a bigger story than your rockumentary, if you will. This is a family story. This is a spiritual story, you know. So it just evolved. I felt honored to be able to tell the story.
All you false pretenders and your freaky contenders trying to be the first. In my own opinion, you are not defending. You are the worst.
And it's crazy listening to the music. It's like it sounds like something that it has that sound of inspiring so many things that came after it. It's really kind of mind-blowing.
When I first heard the track, I was like, this is something that I've heard before. I, you know, just being a fan of punk and proto-punk and listening to Iggy and the Stooges and MC5 and Bad Brains, and this just sounded so familiar.
So you knew Bobby Sr. He had never mentioned Death ever to you, correct?
Never. I felt the same way that Julia, like, you know, as Julia mentions in the documentary, like, Dad, why didn't you tell me? I was the same way. Bob, why didn't you tell me about this band?
You know, when I saw Alice Cooper, it was like, you know, all bets are off, man. To me, if we ain't playing this, then I ain't gonna be having no fun.
Rock and roll just kind of, we just kind of immersed ourselves in it. That's what David called it. He said, it's pure rock and roll, man. Not like you're going to have your one hit, but the pure rock and roll is what they don't play over the radio.
In the film, they talk about the Detroit sound and Motown and that sort of thing. And do you have any idea of, were they influenced by other things going on in Detroit as far as, you know, Iggy and the Stooges, MC5, that sort of thing? Or were they just coming up with this on their own based on their separate inspirations?
David actually saw MC5 in 67, and so he was really inspired by MC5. Not so much musically, but just like, you know, it was just such a happening and an energetic band. And, you know, and then obviously listening to the Stooges and stuff like that, they definitely acknowledge that. But Rockfire Funk Express was the funk band that they had started in 72, 73, so they actually issued a 7-inch recently on Jack White's Third Man Records label that just came out. So it was Dennis seeing Alice Cooper telling his brothers, and then basically a couple months later when David went and saw The Who, it was like, we got to play this kind of music. There is no other music than this. This is what we're playing. And him as sort of the band leader, I mean, okay, you're in charge. Let's do this. Let's write this music. And so, you know, it was just going off of sort of what they had heard and just sort of making it up as they went along. You know, they're all self-taught musicians.
David had a slogan. He said, if I could play chords like Peter Townsend and play lead like Jimi Hendrix, I am the ideal guitar player.
It's pretty amazing, some of the, the guitar work. I mean, I've talked to other guitar players, and, you know, Vernon Reid and Wayne Kramer and stuff about his guitar playing. And, I mean, it's just, you know, they're like, you know, he's solid. He's a solid player.
He's solid, and his tone is incredible, too. I mean, it's the kind of tone people are really trying to reach. I mean, it's just like the amps are on the right over the edge of breaking up, and it's so dynamic, his playing.
Even if you listen to some of the demo stuff, I mean, there's the Spiritual Mental Physical album on Drag City Records as well, which is, you know, mainly just demos where they just sort of stuck a mic in the room, did all four-track stuff. Even that is just phenomenal. I mean, it's just, yeah, the tone is there, you know. It's just his Marshall stack, you know, the way he had it configured and set up. Just had it dialed.
Yeah.
Just right.
Bobby was in school. I was at work. So when we get home, David says, man, I got this great, great new idea for the name of the band. So he holds us in suspense. Let's run up to the room and find out what this great name is that David then came up with. We're waiting with much suspense, and as soon as he says, yeah, this is the name, dude. Death.
Death. Oh, man.
So me and Bobby just kind of looked at each other as if to say, this dude's gone way off the deep end. I know what I would do if somebody came up to me talking about their band, the name of their band was Death. I'm like, I don't want to hear it. But there again, that old thing in the back of your head kicks in, back up your brother, back up your brother.
David always said that our name would have shock value. And we're like, why would you say that? He says, because death is real.
He had so much conviction, so much belief, until we just went along with it.
And that was right around the spring of 1974. Yeah, that's when we became Death.
As a leader, he had, and you know, when people check out the film, they'll see all the great ideas and his concepts on the band and, you know, the artwork and everything. But with the band being called Death at that time, and with those three guys, I mean, his vision was so strong that he wouldn't even change the name for Clive Davis. And for listeners that might not know who he is, Clive Davis signed Bruce Springsteen, Pink Floyd, Patti Smith. I was watching this and listening to Dennis and Bobby talk about it, and you know, I was getting frustrated along with them, but ultimately there was something so genuine and just beautiful about his belief in their music and their concept, and in a really, you know, punk rock way of no compromises.
He stood his ground,
yeah,
you know, for his brothers and himself. You know, he said, you know, I'm not changing our name for anyone.
Yeah.
And you know, he's just a true believer in in the art of music, you know. I mean, it's just a true testament to that if they take this, if they take my name, they take my identity, is the way that David saw things. Mm. And I mean, I admire that.
I got this setting with Clive Davis, and it caused a very interesting stir because they were really focused on this record and they wanted to get involved in it.
The first reaction was, hey, this, yeah, it's great stuff.
Possibly we may be on the brink of a deal, but there's one sticking point. Clive Davis expressed that he really didn't care for the name of the band.
Brian had told us, he said, you guys might have a record deal if you are willing to change the name.
That sent David into another place because he had his death concept, and the concept went with the name, and the band went with the concept, and nothing could change.
David, in no uncertain terms, just said, tell Clive Davis to go to hell.
Okay, so David, our illustrious leader, turned the deal down.
As a fellow artist, I commend him for that, and I know it's his brothers do now, but I know that back then, in the 70s, it was definitely a struggle that,
sure,
you know, hey, David's in charge here, but we're going to back up our brother.
Yeah, that commitment to each other really comes through. It's really, really touching.
See, we grew up in the black community, so at that time, people were tuning in to like groups like Earth, Wind & Fire.
And, you know, here we are in the middle of all of this playing rock and roll.
And, I mean, it wasn't a rock and roll culture.
White boy music.
I mean, the more people tried to talk to us about changing, I think the deeper we went into rock and roll.
Watch those things now!
They're three black guys making this music in the early 70s. It seemed like it was more like the name that kept them out. I mean, do you think, though, that they did have a hard time distributing themselves because of their race and, you know, the style of music they were playing?
It could have had a factor. I mean, the big factor was the neighbors in the neighborhood. I mean, they were expecting, you know, the guys to play some Motown music, and they were really pissing them off playing this heavy driving hard rock and roll.
Yeah.
We spoke with Wayne Kramer about this, and he said if Death played, like, open for us at the Grand Ballroom in Detroit, it would have been a whole different story.
Wow, yeah.
It's amazing to hear something that like that from Wayne, and to know that, you know, it would have been or could have been something a lot different than what it is today, you know. So it could, you know, the album they recorded, that United Sounds for the Whole World to See, could have came out in 76, you know.
Everyone seems so comfortable around you. I mean, as a filmmaker, was there anything you did or tried to make them feel so comfortable to open up, or, you know, was it just natural?
You know, to be honest, it just became natural, you know. Sometimes we had done a couple interviews that are in the film, you know. We had gotten to a point where Mark and I just became part of the family. Just through the process, you just get to a comfort level where nothing's off the table. Everything's in the open. There's interviews that sort of thread throughout the entire film of Bobby and Dennis when they're, you know, wearing their death, the blue jackets and stuff.
Yeah.
Those interviews each for 10 to 12 hours. I had actually sat down with Bob and I said, look, we're going to ask you everything. This interview is going to be a very long interview. Here's 5 or 6 pages of questions, and we're going to go through it all. And he said, okay, let's do this. I think we had one break for pizza, and that was it.
How long were you with them total in the process of making the film?
Sure, the process of making the film was 3 years of production and a year of post-production. Mm.
Let me ask you, is this your first feature-length film?
This is my first feature-length film, and it's my co-director, Mark's second.
How is that working with a co-director?
I think it's really important, especially for this project, to have a co-director, because I sort of acted as a director-producer just because I have a family and I couldn't get to all the shoots. And so Mark, he jumped right in. And actually, we filmed almost every interview, excluding Henry Rollins and Wayne Kramer. It was just a natural thing for him to become my co-director.
This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm Eddie Garcia, and I've been speaking with Charlotte-based filmmaker Jeff Howlett. His new film, A Band Called Death, opens at the Geeksboro Coffee House Cinema July 19th, and it'll run through the 25th. We'll be back with the second half of our interview after this short break.
Everyone looks very strange today. All of the faces seem to be washed away.
Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm technical producer Eddie Garcia, and I've been speaking with Charlotte-based filmmaker Jeff Howlett about his rockumentary, A Band Called Death. I asked him about how he got the likes of Jello Biafra, Alice Cooper, and Vernon Reid to go on the record talking about the music of Detroit's death, and we also talked about the experience of filming an independent feature-length documentary. You had so many big music names talk to you in this film. Questlove, Alice Cooper, even Elijah Wood. I guess he runs a record label or something. Is that correct?
Yeah, he runs Simeon Records.
Oh, okay. Was it difficult to get all that arranged, or were people just like, yes, I want to talk about this band?
Alice Cooper, I contacted his manager, and he's like, yeah, Alice would love to do it. Everybody that's in the film really wanted to be part of the film. I mean, we were in NBC Studios in the Roots dressing room interviewing Questlove, and it's supposed to be, I think, a 30-minute interview, and it ended up being an hour and a half. They were going to be doing a dress rehearsal, and Quest says, what's going on here is more important than the dress rehearsal at this moment in time. And so he gave us an hour and a half of his time, and that was amazing to me that, he said, we're making history here.
Yeah.
I was really moved by that.
And it's just one of those great music stories. It's one of those things that keeps you going to the record store, hoping for another great story like that. It's why you listen to music.
It instantly became a favorite record. It was sort of, it literally popped out of the speakers and it had an energy to it and a musicianship that sort of blew my mind.
When I got to hearing Politicians in My Eyes, it was like an immediate, like, this is one of the greatest songs I've heard in quite some time, and it really was quite an electrifying recording.
Ramones got all the glory for what this is right here, and this is pretty much the Ramones, but 2 years earlier.
There's no doubt on that record. There's only conviction. There's only full-hearted conviction. And that's really what makes it rock and roll.
And everybody's just so giving of their time, to be part of this. And not only that, but our crew and just people that volunteered to help us make this film possible. I mean, they're acknowledged in our credit list, but I can't say enough about how much love and dedication our whole film crew gave of their time and effort to, which really made it possible. And our producers that came on board, about a year and a half in.
So tell me what the festival experience has been like, and how the reception has been.
Oh, the festival experience has been phenomenal. I mean, we had our world premiere at the Los Angeles Film Festival at LA Live, and we had two screenings, and they were both sold out, and we had an encore screening added. So that was a great way to sort of jumpstart our festival experience. From there, we went and we played IDFA in Amsterdam, and it was received great there as well. And we also did a local screening in Vermont last year that was just exhilarating. We had a packed house there, and the band played. We did a question and answer with both Mark and I and the fellas in the band, and it was just a great time. It was great to get all the family members out, you know, extended family and stuff like that to the screening. And then just recently, South by Southwest, we won the 24/7 Audience Award. So that was, you know, stamp of approval, if you will.
Yeah.
It's been great. We got picked up by Draft House Films when we played South by. It was around that time the announcement was made. It was really exciting that it's not just festivals we're playing at. We actually got picked up by an awesome company, and Draft House Films, Tim and the whole crew over there at Draft House have just been great to work with.
How did the family react when they saw the film?
The family was just completely blown away. I mean, I know that when we played the entire film for the family and our crew, it was just a very emotional experience. I mean, there wasn't a dry eye in the house. It was such an emotional thing. I mean, I know to this day that when Bobby and Dennis go see this movie, it brings tears to their eyes. It's still a very emotional ride for them. It's just amazing that you're able to tell the story and make them happy too as a family.
Technical producer Eddie Garcia spoke with A Band Called Death co-director Jeff Howlett. You've been listening to Death on Triad Arts Weekend. On the way, we've got original music by composer, soprano saxophonist, ethnomusicologist, and just all-around musically knowledgeable guy Andrew Raffo Duer. He's been pushing the boundaries of how music is shared, interpreted, and performed for years, and he'll share his latest material music, hot off the press, from elsewhere in Greensboro. But first, Frédéric Chopin certainly pushed the boundaries of piano composition, and Peter Karoff is back at the keyboard to help us better understand classical music next, when Triad Arts Weekend continues.